This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 126. Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or portfolio for your photography. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support team. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. Today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world. Today we are all virtually gathered to nerd out for 40 minutes and talk photography and learn all that we can. We are joined today by Darren Meller, Nick Page, and Brian McGuckin. Welcome to the show, guys.
Howdy.
Thanks for having me. Hey.
Well, we have some interesting stories to talk about today, some news things that have been happening, and also we are going to learn a little bit about Windows 10 and some of the things that are coming on. We have heard the complaints more than a few times about Windows and Mac, and that we're a little bit too Mac-focused on the show, although we do have two Windows people on the show. But we're going to learn a little bit about Windows 10 that's coming up and how it might impact photographers. And then in the main segment, we're going to talk about something that photographers really, really struggle with, and that is getting sharper photos. Not from a theoretical sense, but what actually really does make a difference. But before we get to that, I want to invite you to send in your submissions for editors on Improved Photography. Jeff Harmon is our hobbyist editor, and he's getting lots of articles up on Improved Photography, really targeted toward hobbyist photographers, people that are not doing photography as their main source of income. But we want to focus on other topics as well and get lots more information on the website. So we are looking for a gear editor, somebody who will write product reviews, and we have ways to get lots of product to you, and also somebody to write about nature photography. And we could probably also use somebody for portrait photography as we grow. But especially, we are looking for those two new editors on Improved Photography. If you enjoy writing and you like nerding out about photography and you want to earn a little extra side income for new gear, you can email us at editors@improvephotography.com. That's editors@improvephotography.com. Just write a paragraph or two. Tell us about yourself. You know, if you're experienced in photography, or if you're just a hobbyist who likes to nerd out and listen to all the podcasts and read all the blogs all the time, send us a link to your portfolio. You know, tell us why you're interested in doing it. Just kind of tell us more about you. You don't have to be the world's best photographer in the world, but we do want somebody who's really into everything photography. If you can't get enough podcasts, you're reading all the blogs all the time, and you have good knowledge to share, you'd be perfect. Email us at editors@improvephotography.com. All right. And also, we want to talk about some of these other stories. First, let's jump right into Windows 10, because that was the big news this week. Did you all see the announcement for Windows 10?
I did.
And when would you see? I mean, you're the Windows guy here, Nick. Is there anything that interested you or you thought about interesting with Windows 10?
Well, you know, I feel like, as opposed to the newest version of Lightroom or Photoshop, those are things that everybody looks forward to and we're excited to get our hands on the newest thing. A new version of Windows is like the thing that we all dread, because I feel like every time Windows changes, we have to completely relearn our computer. I have a Windows 7 machine, and it's that way on purpose because I hate Windows 8. Once you learn a system, you want to just stick with it. It works. And when I heard that Windows 10 is coming out, I just briefly went over some of the details on it. Jeff is far more knowledgeable about it than I am. But I'm dreading having to relearn relearn an operating system. It's always just like pulling teeth trying to find where to change the simple settings that I used to know exactly where they are. And now they're somewhere else. And so every time Windows updates, I sigh and avoid upgrading as long as I can.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. I'll say my opinion on this, and I want to hear what you guys think of this. Does Photoshop run better on a Mac than on Windows? Personally, I say absolutely not. I heard that so many times before I switched to Mac that, oh, it just works better for photographers. And if you do graphic design, you got to work on a Mac. That is a bunch of baloney. I saw no difference in the stability of Photoshop and Lightroom, in the speed of Photoshop and Lightroom. I don't see any specific feature on a Mac that makes it particularly suited to working in photography or something. I think a lot of photographers are interested in Macs because it's a very visual, nice, clean appearance, and photographers are very visual people. And I think that's really the only draw specifically for photography. There are a lot of reasons to switch to a Mac, but I heard so many creatives saying, oh, you've got to use a Mac if you want to do serious media work. And I just don't even get where that comes from. Darren, Brian, what do you guys think of that?
Well, I honestly was a Windows user from day one. That was what I learned on. We had an old Gateway 2000, and I remember that was like $2,000, and it had maybe a couple megabytes of hard drive space, extremely slow back when internet used to make to log in with AOL. And that's what I learned on. I actually learned how to build PCs. But then finally, one day in 2007, I went through a PC, a laptop in college that just lasted about 6 months. And maybe it was the video games I was playing and stuff like that. But it just always seemed to kind of crap out on me really quickly. And I just said, I'm going to try this Macintosh thing. And it was a huge learning curve to switch over to it because I guess my way of explaining is you kind of have to stop thinking so critically about the operating system, and you have to think more along the fluid lines of how things would work. And that's was the difficult transition for me. But now I would never go back to a Windows machine because to me it almost seems counterintuitive to do certain things within Windows, even going back to some of the Microsoft Office programs.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate that. I love my Mac. I would not go back. But one, I will comment on one thing. You said that, you know, you had a computer that lasted 7 months and died on you. I've definitely had that too. And I felt the same way when I switched to Mac. Looking back though, sometimes I think back and I think, well, did I ever spend $2,000 on a Windows machine? Mm-hmm. Because maybe it's just that I bought cheaper Windows machines.
Very exactly. True. That definitely could be a good point because I was always looking for that bargain machine, and it was really a big pill to swallow when I walked up to my first MacBook Pro. And
huge. Yeah. Huge. Every time I buy something from Apple, it's like, this is not fun to pay that much money, but I've never regretted it so far.
No, mm-hmm. Not at all.
Brian, what do you think?
When I was in fourth grade, back in the days,
they didn't have computers back then.
No. I'm older than you. My mom was a computer teacher. She brought in an Apple IIc computer into our classroom, and we used to do a computer club, and we did Turtle Logo, where you put in all these commands to have the turtle put its tail down and then move forward, and it draws a line, then pick the tail up and then turn it. And you guys have no clue what I'm talking about. Man, you guys are young.
Anyways, look it up. Trail generation.
And Carmen Sandiego.
Yeah. This is way before that. So since those days, I've always been an Apple person. So I've never used a PC to do any type of photography stuff at all. So I have no comment on how it is using a PC for Photoshop or Lightroom. But with my Mac that I've always had, I've always been happy with it. So I don't know much about Windows.
All right. Well, let's throw it over to Jeff Harmon now. He's going to, he's our Windows correspondent who recorded a little tidbit to catch us up on Windows 10, but he couldn't be on the show tonight.
Hey, everyone. I sure wish I could be there in person because I really was looking forward to nerding out over Windows 10. Yeah, I'm sure none of the other hosts are even wanting to do that, but I do. It's what I do. All right. So I wanted to talk very quickly about Windows 10 and what's coming, what to expect. You know, Mac users, which a huge portion of our listening audience are users of Mac, they're used to getting their updates announced at WWDC, which is coming up real soon, and then seeing the new goodies that Apple's got in store and then having it roll out. And occasionally there's been some challenges that Apple's gone through, like anyone does, in rolling these things out. But you're used to getting updates frequently. The Windows side, the users aren't. That's not how it works. The versions have been much further apart, and usually were really, really painful. Going from one to the next was so rough. You didn't ever want to. The recommendations have always been, don't upgrade in place. You don't want to go from one this version to another one. You want to go buy a new computer. You want to get a new computer that has the new OS just freshly and cleanly installed. It's the best way to go and get it. And so as Windows 10 comes up, and Microsoft just announced this week that on July 29th, 2015, it will be made available for the world to get. When it comes, should photographers get it? So I want to go over a couple of questions that I'm betting a lot of you have. I'm going to have an article published on June 8th, Monday, that's coming up here, that has a lot more detail. So if you're interested in getting a lot more information about my view of Windows 10 and whether photographers should be going to it and what the changes are and what to expect, then check that article out on Monday. But very, very briefly, let's talk about a couple of questions I'm betting you have. The first one is it free? Is it really, really free? And the answer is yes, surprisingly. Microsoft's really trying to make it so that everyone wants to go to the new version. They don't want to have to support something that's really old. They don't want to fall into the XP trap. They're still trying to get people out of that. So they're making it free. They're making the upgrade completely free. And that's a big, big change. But there are two conditions. You have to have either a Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 license. You have to be using that and running that today. And number two, you have to do it within 12 months of the release of Windows 10. So you have until July 29th, 2016 to upgrade for free. The question that usually follows then when I say it that way is, wait, does that mean if I install it now, if I install it like in August, and then August 2016 comes around, I'm going to have to pay for it then? Is it only free for me to use for the next year, and then I have to pay for it? No, it is free. As long as you do the installation in those 12 months after release, it is free. That's great. They're also working really, really hard to make sure that you can do an in-place upgrade. So if you're on Windows 7, they're trying to make it really work well, that you can upgrade to Windows 10 and have everything go well, have it work flawlessly. We'll see it. I'll see it when I believe it. I still am not convinced that a fresh, clean install isn't the best way to go, but we'll see. They still have some more time to work on this. Okay, so that's the free thing. You may also have noticed that there's a brand new icon that's on your computer. If you're installing updates regularly, then you probably got a new icon down there on the taskbar. It looks like a Windows logo. And if you click on it, it says, reserve your copy of Windows 10 today. And that may bring questions. Well, first of all, Microsoft has never delivered an icon to your taskbar like that. That's totally new. And some people I've heard have said, is that a virus? Do I have a problem? Because it's not something anyone's expected. No, it's not a virus. That is from Microsoft. And it's a little different, but it is from Microsoft. But what does it mean then to reserve the copy? Does that mean there's like a limited number of these free licenses that they're going to give out to everybody over that 12 months? And if you don't reserve your copy, they might run out of those licenses, those free ones that they're going to give out? The answer is no. What they're wanting to do here when you reserve your copy is try to avoid a massive rush on July 29th to have everyone download it. It's going to be a very large download, something like 3 gigabytes of data that you're going to have to download to do the upgrade. And they want to avoid having 200 million, 300 million, a half billion people all trying to download it at once. And so they're going to trickle feed. They're going to buy small amounts of data over many days, maybe weeks. Send the data down to your computer so that it's all available on the 29th of July, and then it'll come up and say, you're ready to go, and you don't even have to wait for a download to happen. So they're trying to improve the experience of the user, even in how you get the bits to install the application. Seems like it's a very good direction. Now, the other question then is, would I recommend it? Do I recommend that you go reserve your copy right now and that August 1st you go upgrade your Windows 7 install, since I'm guessing most of you are on Windows 7? And I'm going to say it's still too early to tell. It's weird because they only have a couple months that I can't tell you whether or not I think it's worth doing. It's just, it's a tough thing. So there's two reasons for it why I'm not sure I can tell you. The first is the UI changed drastically in Windows 8. It was a major, major bet that Microsoft made in Windows 8 to try to make the UI futuristic, and they took a major gamble and they lost. And it was something that most users found confusing, difficult to use, and that's why you probably have heard that you don't want to touch Windows 8, like, at all. You want to avoid it like the plague. You may even have gone to great lengths to make sure that as you got a new computer that should have had Windows 8 on it, that you downgraded to Windows 7 and that you used Windows 7 because Windows 8 is so terrible. And the reality is, yeah, the UI was a little confusing, but I'm confident I could take 10 minutes and help everyone understand exactly what it is. But boy, you shouldn't need 10 minutes of explanation to figure out how to use something. That's just terrible. And that's why the market hasn't really accepted Windows 8. Well, Windows 10 adopts most of that UI still. They're still pushing forward on a lot of those concepts and ideas, which overall I think are the right direction and good. It was just too big a change. It was too jarring. It was so hard to go from Windows 7 to Windows 8 and not understand what to do with the OS. So they're backpedaling a little bit. Microsoft is making some concessions and some changes. They're making it so that that transition from Windows 7 to Windows 10 should be significantly easier. It should make a lot more sense, but we don't really know for sure because it's not done. And that's kind of the other point of why it is I don't think I can tell you whether or not you should do it. There have been technical previews given to developers since late 2014 of Windows 10. And Microsoft was really clear as they were delivering those that they were working on the lower levels of the operating system first. They were working on stuff beneath the UI. Things that they wanted to improve so that the performance was better and that they had better things to build the UI with. And so those initial releases way back in 2014 were awful. They were, and they knew it. Microsoft, they knew where they were at. They knew it was going to be. And then as the releases have come, it's slowly gotten better. But even as late as this week in 2015 here, they're not solid enough. They're still so buggy that it wouldn't be good for day-to-day use. The testers, the media, there's people writing about this. They were trying really hard to dive in and use Windows 10, and it's just not stable yet. So they have a couple of months. Do I expect for it to stay that way? No way. Microsoft cannot afford to have a launch day that is fraught with bugginess and instability. It has to be smooth and elegant. It has to go in place, upgrade just fine. It's got to go well, or they're going to continue to lose a foothold in the marketplace. They're going to continue to have a major problem. So I expect there's going to be some significant fit and finish applied to those builds way before July 29th when it gets released, and it's probably going to be really, really good. But we haven't seen it yet, so I can't tell you if I recommend it or not. Most likely, just looking into my crystal ball, I'm guessing you're going to want to wait. You're not going to want to do it on August 1st. You're not going to want to do it probably by September 1st. You're probably going to want to wait several months, let others, early adopters, go through it and see how it is, see what it is. Hey, stay tuned to this podcast and the website, and I'm going to do that for photographers in specific. I'm going to go through the install. I'm going to go through the process, and I'm going to tell you whether or not I think you should be going to Windows 10. And that's going to be important to understand because you have a year to do it for free, or you can go get a new computer and get Windows 10. But if you're happy with the hardware you have in your computer, and you're just interested in getting to the latest version of Windows, and if there's any benefits, then you got to do it. You have to decide in that first year so that you can get it for free. So that's the biggest things I wanted to represent today. And now we will send you back to the hosts, and they can discuss my nerdiness.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm anxious to see what comes out in Windows 10. With Windows 8, it definitely annoyed a lot of users. So hopefully Microsoft will hit it out of the park and give us all a little bit better experience for our photo editing. But before we go on and talk about our main segment of sharpness today, we want to take a second and thank Squarespace for helping us, for helping to make the Improved Photography Podcast possible. Squarespace is the company that makes my photography portfolio look good and actually update it because it's easy to use and it's really, really inexpensive. It's one expense that I just never have to second guess. I mean, $8 a month and we'll get you started on Squarespace. And it everything works. It's all there, everything you're wanting to do, and you're set to go. Darren and Nick, I know you guys are using Squarespace. What have you been thinking of it?
I love how easy it is to keep updated on it. I know before I used Squarespace, I was terrible about keeping my galleries updated and with my thousands of photos that I put on my website. But it's super nice for the ease of use. And I'm actually going to start using the commerce feature on it to start selling some of my landscape photos as wallpaper art and stuff. So just super handy. Everything's easy to use. I really like it.
Yeah, that's a really cool upgrade in Squarespace, is now that you can actually sell things from the website, especially for photographers that, you know, maybe you don't sell things very often, but you would at least like it to be possible to sell some prints mm-hmm. and things on there. It's cool. It's right in Squarespace. Everything's there for you. So you can do what you want with your photography portfolio quickly, and it doesn't have to be a huge distraction from all the things you have to do. And Darren, I know you're loving Squarespace as well. I've been checking out your website. You can come see mine at photographyidaho.com if you want to see some of the photos that we talk about often on the show. And we'll put links into everybody else's Squarespace sites as well in our show notes. But be sure to check out Squarespace. You can get a discount on your Squarespace by using the offer code IMPROVE at checkout. That'll get you 10% off your purchase. You can start your free trial today. No credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com and use that offer code IMPROVE to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. All right, we want to talk about sharpness, in part because of a technology that I know a lot of people have been asking about on the website, called electronic front curtain shutter. This came out first in the Q&A section of improvephotography.com. Somebody was asking about it, and so I wrote an article kind of explaining electronic first curtain shutter and how it works. It's really interesting. There are not a lot of Nikon cameras that do it, and by not a lot, I mean one. Canon, however, has a lot of models. Most of their models can do electronic first curtain shutter, as well as Sony. Most of the Sony models can do this, and a lot of the other Micro Four Thirds, Fuji has cameras that can do this. Panasonic has cameras that do this. It's a pretty interesting technology. So the whole purpose of electronic first curtain shutter is that it's reducing the vibration from the mirror slapping up and down or the shutter itself just moving. Some people mistakenly say that you don't have a front curtain shutter in mirrorless cameras, but actually there are mirrorless cameras that do this because even the shutter moving does cause some vibration. So in your cell phone, there's no physical shutter. There's no actual blinder that goes over the imaging sensor to start and stop the exposure. It's just an electronic. It just turns on the sensor to start recording and turns it off. Now, that's much less precise. It's just not as precise as having a physical shutter go over the sensor. So in our DSLRs, our Sirius cameras, the way that it works is it has one shutter go up and then the next one. But this is electronic first curtain shutter. Is all it's doing is there's only one curtain of the shutter. It starts by just turning on the sensor, and then it's followed by a physical shutter in the back. So it reduces vibration because the mirror doesn't have to flap in sync, and also the first curtain of the shutter is not causing that much vibration. So it cuts down a little bit on the vibration in the camera. Have you guys tried electronic first curtain shutter?
Not me.
No, the closest I've come is mirror lockup.
Yeah, okay. So mirror lockup is similar, but it doesn't impact the shutter. The shutter still works the exact same when you're using mirror lockup. And this is talking about the shutter itself. So it's definitely interesting. Now, if you look up technical articles on this, it's rare that you're going to see any kind of side-by-side on this because, I mean, we're talking about a scientific small difference in the photo 99% of the time. There are certain situations where that you can actually see a difference side by side. And that would be when we're right around that 1/5, 1/10 of a second shutter speed, not slower than that, not faster than that, just right at those shutter speeds. And when you have a very long lens on, when you're doing macro photography, it's going to be a little bit more pronounced. Or even when you're doing night photography, where you have those tiny little stars that you're going to notice if they're a tiny, tiny little bit blurry. So those are situations where you're going to see it more pronounced. But again, we're talking about a tiny difference, and only at certain shutter speeds are you going to see any significant difference. Do I use EFCS? No, because it's not on my camera. If I had it on Canon and I noticed I was at 1/5, 1/10 of a second, or I was doing something really scientific with a long lens or something, yeah, I mean, it's something to quick turn on, but not something to really worry about too much either. So that's an interesting technical one that's kind of been talked about a little bit on the forum. What else do you guys think for sharpness?
Well, it's kind of one of those general rules of thumb, but there's the whole shutter speed versus focal length thing. And I just got done leading a workshop, and it surprises me how many people don't really take into consideration their shutter speed as much as they should when they're shooting handheld. Keeping your shutter speed faster than the length of your focal length dramatically helps get sharper shots. When you start having shutter speeds that are too slow, that's when you start getting shutter handshake, and it's amazing how many people are not taking that into consideration, especially when you first start to shoot in manual mode and you're taking control of your camera. That's when you really start to run into that problem.
Yeah, so the general rule is 1/1 the focal length of the lens. So if you're using a 100mm lens, then your shutter speed should be no slower than 1/100. If you're using a 25mm lens, well, then it shouldn't be any slower than 1/1/25. So it shouldn't be 1/10 or 1/5 or 1/4. It should be something like 1/100th, 1/200th, 1/300th. Anything above that is just fine. And you can tell your focal length by looking at the lens and just seeing what you're zoomed out to at the moment. So do you follow that rule kind of as the gospel truth, or are there situations where you cheat on that?
There's certainly times when I cheat on it. For example, when I have really nice image stabilization built into the lens, then, for example, my 70-200 has a really nice image stabilizer in it. So there's times when I can hand hold that as slow as like 1/50th and 1/25th of a second. And that's just because the image stabilizer in it compensates for a lot of that handshake. But, you know, that only lasts up into a certain point, and then it no longer can help you. But yeah, and obviously if you're on a tripod, this is completely null and void. It doesn't matter anymore. Shutter speed, as long as you have a nice sturdy tripod, no longer matters when it comes to your sharpness.
Brian and Darren, do you follow the 1/1 focal length rule?
I do it for the most part, unless I'm just on a tripod or something like that. And then I'll kind of break the rules or try to hold my breath and just kind of spray and pray. But that's really the only time I'll break it, because after learning it and seeing the effect, I think that it's really important to make sure that you're doing that and not really relying on the lens, because sometimes I might get used to a lens like Nick was talking about that has the great image stabilization, then throw a different one on there that doesn't really have as much capability in that regard, and boom, I have a blurry image that could have just been great.
For me, the two main lenses I use most of the time both have the image stabilization in it. So I would say I'm kind of similar to Nick as far as, if I am shooting around 1/60th of a second or slower, if I'm concerned about it, then sometimes I'll just make sure that I've got like high speed burst and hold it down and shoot mm-hmm. 5 shots really quick and hope that maybe my third or fourth shot might be a little bit crisper than the first shot. But as far as paying attention to the actual rule, I think I tend to do that, but I don't intentionally do it.
Yeah, the lens that drives me crazy, by the way, with image stabilization is the 24-70, the 24-70mm f2.8, like the one that just about every professional photographer owns. No image stabilization. Exactly. It drives me crazy. Absolutely unless, crazy, because that's a lens that I use in low light constantly. Like when I'm, if I'm shooting a wedding, an event, something like that, I mean, I'm going to use the 24 to 70 and all the time I'm like, oh, I wish I could go down to 1/5 of a second, and you just can't. It just drives me absolutely crazy.
Although the Tamron one does have the image stabilization. So I think that because some of these third-party lenses are starting to put image stabilization in, like, in even their wide-angle lenses, I suspect that there's going to be, you know, Canon and Nikon lenses in that focal length that come out later on, and they're going to have an image stabilization just because the third-party lenses kind of forced their hand and made them kind of reassess that, because a lot of video shooters, they love having that image stabilization because it's so nice to be able to do video handheld like that and have a more stable shot.
Right. I totally agree with that. I got the new Tamron 15-30, which is $1,000 wide angle lens, like world class wide angle lens. Like, it's really, really good for $1,000. That's unheard of for a full frame wide angle lens. You just, that doesn't exist until this lens. And it is really, really good. I know, Darren, you have one as well. And that's one thing that I, when I got it, I thought, well, that's kind of silly to have image stabilization on it, because I thought, well, if I'm using a wide angle, I'm on a tripod, I mean, almost all the time. But when we were in China, I realized, no, that's not the case at all. In fact, I used the 15-30 to shoot a lot of video while I was there, and I was really glad to have image stabilization. Image stabilization makes a huge difference in when you're shooting video. And I ended up shooting that lens handheld a lot because I just wanted to be able to move around quickly and shoot stuff. And so, you know, on the landscape, sure, I still use the tripod, but I was shooting people in low light with a wide angle lens sometimes to get kind of that really wide environmental portrait. And I loved having the image stabilization. So I think every lens should have it. The camera manufacturers are just wanting to put it on the longer lenses, but man, I want every lens with image stabilization from now on.
Yeah, I'm curious. I was going to say, I'm curious how slow of a shutter speed you could handhold that, because if you use that 1/1 focal length formula, you should, I mean, without stabilization, you could handhold that at 1/15th of a second. I bet you could handhold that at like 1 second. That's just crazy.
Yeah, and with four stops image stabilization, I haven't tested the full limits. Like, I haven't tested 1 second. I mean, the shots that I did do with it were really, really sharp at slower shutter speeds.
On my 70-200, I always just keep the image stabilization on. But I have heard that there are times when you should turn them off.
Yeah, when you're on a tripod, there are some lenses that you need to turn off. Most lenses you don't need to. But when image stabilization was new, that hadn't quite been put into the technology yet to sense that, oh, we're not moving, don't turn on image stabilization. And so there are some lenses that you shouldn't have it on for. Check the back of your lens. If it's an older lens, an older design of a lens, it doesn't matter if you bought it yesterday or not. If it's an older design of a lens, that's something you probably want to check on just to make sure that doesn't affect your lens, that you need to turn it off when you're on a tripod. But most lenses do that by itself.
Yeah, and actually on a newer lens, when I was in France, I kept shooting pictures of Notre Dame in Lyon, and it was on a tripod, perfectly still, and it was the Tamron 70-200 that competes with the Canon one, that's a little less sharp in regards to, a little less expensive also, and I kept getting blurry shots. I was doing everything correctly, and then finally my friend walked over and he's like, shut the vibration control off, and the image came back crystal clear. And that's a newer lens, so like Jim said, I think it's dependent on the lens. There's some other photographers that'll tell you, you know, a blanket statement that you can turn it off on all lenses that are newer, but I think just make sure you know your lens well enough to not miss that shot because you left that on or off when you needed it or did not need it.
Very good point. Darren, you also had another tip for getting better sharpness in your photos.
Yeah, mine covers the other two ends of the exposure triangle, and that one of them is ISO. Cameras are getting better and better with handling higher ISOs, and this is probably not going to be true and hold its point as long, but higher ISOs can really kill sharpness in photos. Like, for instance, if you start to crop out some of the image and get closer, and you're taking maybe a lifestyle shot with a picture of a fisherman like we have in China, and you zoom in on the face, you're going to notice that some of those spots in there are actually from your ISO. It's not actually pixelated. You're just losing detail because your ISO was cranked too high to try to freeze the action out. So I always recommend keeping your ISO low and then always making sure to select the correct aperture for the shot. So many people will shoot shots that are just amazingly beautiful, and it'll be a picture of a couple, and they love the fact that their lens is fast as far as aperture, and they'll shoot it at f2.8, and the wife will be standing slightly behind the husband in a bridal shoot, and I'll just shake my head and say, oh, you came so close to it. If you just would have stopped to f5.6 or something like that, it just would have been such a better shot. So make sure you watch your ISO and your aperture to ensure that you're getting sharp images in those two respects of the exposure triangle.
Really good point on the ISO. In fact, there was a portfolio that I review that I did today, which, by the way, you can get your own portfolio review from us for $39 at improvephotography.com. We'll look through your photos and give you feedback right on your photos, tell you where you are and where to improve, end commercial. but there was a portfolio review I did today that's something I mentioned, is that the photo looked blurry, and it wasn't blurry. It was just shot at too high of an ISO. And I've always heard, I don't know how many times I've heard this, that, you know, sometimes increasing the ISO adds grain to the picture and it can improve the appearance of sharpness. I have never seen that. I don't know what these people are talking about. I've never seen a photo that's like, whoo, it looks kind of blurry, but good thing there's some grain in there. I've never seen that before. But when you do increase that ISO and it looks noisier, the detail is gonzo. That's one thing that I think is often missed when we're talking about, when I hear people talking about photography online, is you know, raising the ISO, yes, it increases the grain, but it also just destroys the fine detail in the photo. The details are just not there when you add that grain into the picture, when you're shooting at higher ISO. Especially, I'm going to say this is worse on cameras, on Canons, than it is on Nikons. If you look at side-by-sides of Canon compared to Nikon photos, the Canon is applying much more noise reduction to their photos at higher ISOs. And now you say that's just for JPEGs. Not true. We like to think that a raw photo is totally raw, and that's just not how it works. Even the raw photos, they're still applying a little bit of image of noise reduction in those so that they can advertise a higher ISO in their camera. But yeah, when you go to those higher ISOs, it does not look as sharp. At least to the way that I see it, it does not look as sharp. Brian and Nick, what do you guys think of that? Do you agree with that, or are you in the grain looks sharper camp?
I totally agree. Grain does not look sharper. It looks grainier. and at those higher ISOs, not only is it not as sharp, but you're starting to losing all your color. You know, you have far smaller color palette, and a lot of those fine details just start looking mushy. You know, mm-hmm. they're no longer crisp. They're mushy.
Yep. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
I just got done. My daughter went to a sleepover tonight and wanted to take one of my older SLRs, and I was showing her how to shoot in manual mode, and I pulled out the old cheat sheet that showed the ISO and explained that whole difference. And yeah, I definitely, you know, try to shoot as low as possible.
Cool. And I have been impressed, and I'll give some Sony photographers some love. Even though I'm selling my A6000, Jim and I talked about this in China, that whether or not I brought it was really going to be the deciding factor of how much I loved it. I'm selling it for just different reasons. It's not meeting my needs, but I will say that I saw a picture shot with the new Sony Alpha Mark II, and it was shot at ISO 20,000, and I think that they must have done something in post-production or something along those lines to make that picture look not only crisp, but also remove the grain. And that just performed like a monster.
Very cool.
Yeah, the A7, the A7R, those are just awesome sensors. If you're into night photography, those are like the cameras, because I've seen video where they're actually shooting at 1/30th of a second, because that's as slow as you can go in video, and they're at some crazy ISO that, like, on a Canon or an Nikon, it would just look awful, but they're able to give video of the night sky at 1/30th of a second because the ISO performance is so good on these.
Yeah, the A7R, Nikon D800, and Nikon D810 all are using that same basic sensor. They say it's all new and it's not. It's the basic sensor. And that sensor is just was just way ahead of its time when it was released. That's like 5 years ago now that the D800 was released. Has it been that long? It's 4 or 5 years. And that sensor was just way, way, way ahead of its time that even by today's standards, it's still a really, really good sensor. So whenever I see a camera coming out and I see 36 megapixels, I'm hoping it's that Sony sensor because, man, I miss that. I switched from the D810 to the D750 because I love the articulating LCD, the Wi-Fi, and the other features in it that is lighter weight, better grip. I really like that. But sometimes when I look at my photos, I still say, ooh, but I like that sensor. It's just a really good one. And so I'm hoping Sony's new camera that they're coming out with in mid-June, just in a couple weeks now, they should be coming out with the A7R replacement. And I could be a customer for that one. The rumor is that it's using that 36 megapixel sensor. If it's lightweight and the lenses are lightweight, I could be a customer there. Anxious to see if it's gonna meet those needs. Mm-hmm. Brian, how about you? What else do you do for sharpness?
Really, that's about it. I'm not as much of a geek as you guys are with paying attention to the sensors and all that. So I sit back and I learn more from you guys with that topic.
I beg to differ, Brian. You're a pretty big geek.
Thanks.
So one of the things that I feel like people don't really talk about very often is using single point focus to make sure that they're focusing in the correct spot.
Can I get an amen? Yes, you can.
and not only that, but moving that focus point. Anytime you're shooting with a really super shallow depth of field, like one of the 85 millimeters where you're shooting at 1.2 or 1.4, if you're using the center focus point and then focusing and recomposing with that shallow of a depth of field, by the time you recompose, it's going to be blurry again. You're going to miss your focus on the eye that you were probably focusing on. And moving that focus point to the closest focus point to where you want it to be, and then just, you know, barely recomposing your shot, that is absolutely the best way to focus. I also, in addition to that, I use back button focus like all the time now. I don't even use any other type of focus method, but just by being able to move that focus point to the closest focus point to the eye or wherever I'm focusing and then taking the shot immediately, it's a much better, much more technically perfect way of focusing than focusing and recomposing or just letting the camera choose your focus point. I feel like people don't talk about that enough.
Yeah, I agree. And if you want to work with back button focus, just Google back button focus and look for the article from Improved Photography. It's usually the number one on Google. So check that out, or just go to improvephotography.com/BBF. And we have a really in-depth article that I wrote about back button focus and how to set it up on your camera, all that kind of stuff.
Is that BBFF?
No, that's BBF.
Oh, okay.
Like BB your friend.
Not best friends forever.
No, not the same thing. Very different. Now,
I also heard I shoot, my settings are typically set to AI servo because of the weddings and movement and some of the NFL stuff that I get to shoot and other type of events. Is there a difference?
Some of the NFL stuff you get to shoot. Let me just drop that in there. By the way, I'm an all-star on the sidelines shooting Peyton Manning.
Yeah, no, I haven't shot Peyton Manning yet, but I think I am for sure.
Colin Kaepernick, then. Whoever.
Andrew Luck. There you go. But what about when I've also heard, I tend to just keep my settings at AI servo. Do you notice, is there a difference if it was switched to one shot compared to AI servo?
Yeah, from the tests that I've done, it's a very noticeable difference. You know, obviously, you know, when you're shooting your NFL games, you're going to keep it on AI servo, which is the same thing as AFC or continuous focus for Nikon folks, and Sony. But when you're shooting, like, you know, you're shooting the formals of a couple, I would definitely use one shot or AFS, single shot focus, for that. All the time, because it's significantly sharp, more accurate. Now, the best of AI servo and the best of single shot is going to be about equal, but the AI servo is just not nearly as consistent. In fact, if I'm shooting like the formals of a couple, like one out of every six photos, you could say, yeah, that's noticeably not quite perfect sharpness. So I definitely see a difference. If I'm shooting landscapes, portraits where the people are mostly still, products, any kind of thing like that, I'm always on that one shot, single shot focus or single focus. And I think it does make a big difference.
What I hate is when I change it over into one shot and then I'm in a situation where I need AI servo and I forget to change it back. That's probably one of the reasons I leave it in AI servo is because I forget to change it back. So I'll be doing portraits and then the bride will be walking down the aisle and I will still be in one shot, which is not a good thing
because right, yeah.
In that split second between the focus moment and taking the picture, she's probably moved. So switching it back and forth, you just have to remember to switch it back.
Well, very good. We talked about a lot of ways to get your photos a little bit sharper. And on all these topics, if you're one of the beginners just listening to the podcast for the first time, you know, it feels like maybe this is passing over your head a little bit, take some of the things we're talking about here and go look at them on Improved Photography. We have articles on all this kind of stuff all over the website, hundreds of articles with different tutorials. Well, before we leave each week, we want to share a doodad of the week. And Brian, I'm going to throw this to you first. What's the doodad that you're recommending this week?
So a month ago, I was using an external hard drive and I accidentally bumped it. And it fell just 2 feet onto some carpeted floor. And I went to plug it back in and it wouldn't read it. Aww. And I was like, luckily, I back up on multiple external hard drives. But so that was frustrating. So just the other day, I'm a teacher as well. So I'm on my first week of summer vacation. And my goal this summer is to go through, and I've got 13 years of photos and videos of my children, since my oldest is 13, that I want to put on an external hard drive all by itself. So I went out and I bought one, and I could choose a regular one or one that has the little rubber casing for it. And so I'm like, yeah, let's get that, because last time, you know, I shot myself in the foot by not having that. And so as I went to sit down today for this episode, the one I had plugged into my computer fell off and it bounced. And I plugged it back in just as we were talking, and it worked and it was fine. So that is my doodad of the week, having some type of case or shell around your external hard drive if you're the type that tends to move around a lot like I do with my laptop.
You knock two external hard drives onto the floor in a week? Yeah.
Well, hey,
maybe
you know,
the doodad of the week should be, don't let Brian in your studio.
Or a new desk.
And don't put Jim near water with his cameras.
That's exactly right. You do not want to do that. In fact, last month I filmed for a new DVD that I'm coming out with on flash photography. And during the middle of the workshop, the flash goes crash and pieces fly all over the studio floor. I'm just terrible on photo gear. So I feel you there, Brian.
Thank you.
All right, Nick, how about you?
Well, I actually have a do-don't of the week. I just bought this Nero lightning trigger, and it triggers more than just lightning, but I got it for daytime lightning because daytime lightning is the hardest thing ever to photograph. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get this and I'm going to put it to work for some daytime storms. And we just had an awesome storm come through and I was so excited, and I took it out and I would set it up on my camera. The lightning was coming. It was strong, close lightning that should have been triggering it, and it wouldn't trigger. So I would slowly bump up the sensitivity to it, and it wouldn't trigger. And I eventually got it high enough to where it would just trigger all the time because the ambient light was triggering it. So I'd go back down, and then another flash would happen, and it wouldn't trigger. So the only reason I bought this $200 trigger was for daytime lightning, and it totally doesn't work for that. And then I tried using it later in the evening when it was like very little ambient light and these big bright strikes, and I still could not get it to work. And by the time I'm sure I probably could have hung around and got the settings just right, but I would have missed my window of opportunity by doing it that way. So I just busted out the intervalometer and did the bulb mode method, but super let down by the Nero trigger because it didn't work how I wanted it to. I'm sure it works well on its other features. It's got like a sound feature and a laser pointer feature and all these different things, but it sucked for what I wanted it for. So that's my do don't this week.
Thank you for helping me to avoid that purchase. That's great. Darren?
Mine's actually the Westcott 44-inch Apollo Orb Speedlight Kit, and then also you had attached the ProMaster L6 multifunction boom stand. And a listener, Guillermo Flores, he actually posted this on Facebook after this weekend doing an engagement shoot and having that 60-inch newer umbrella that Nick recommended take me away like Mary Poppins and crash on the ground and break, I decided I needed something to replace it. It's a little bit, quite a bit more expensive than the umbrella, but I think my dad and I are going to swing for this just because it seems a little bit more aerodynamic and it looks like it won't catch the wind as much and still produce a lot of nice soft light. And you can also hook a strobe up to it. You can hook multiple speed lights up to it and even a singular speed light as well. And it just seems to give beautiful light, and then also having it on the boom stand gives you really nice angles if you want to do some creative sports photography like Guillermo does, and just kind of do some different things without flying away like Mary Poppins.
Good recommendation. Thanks, Darren. I am going to recommend the Western Digital My Passport Ultra. This is an external hard drive it's wallet sized. It's really small and really, really lightweight. I don't know how it is because it is a spinning drive, but I don't know how it's this fast. I have flash drives, even some that I paid quite a bit of money for, just like thumb drives when I want to transfer a big file, or another place that I use it is when I'm traveling. I like to have, you know, I spend a lot of money to go travel to this place across the world, a different country. And so I want to make sure my photos are backed up in a bunch of places, especially when I'm, you know, getting on airplanes with them and stuff. And so I like to have the photos on my SD cards. I transfer them over to my laptop every night because I love editing them. And then before I leave the country, I also go from my laptop and I back up everything to an external drive. And that's what I put in my checked bag. So I have one thing in my carry-on and one in my checked bag and another in my other carry-on just to make sure that I have all of my photos. And this one is great. It's just super fast for transferring big files, very light, and pretty inexpensive too. It was under $100. So Western Digital My Passport Ultra. Now they do have a version of these that has a place where you can just put in your SD card and it'll dump all your stuff. Not recommended. I have talked to several people that have them and they said they're just super, super buggy. So I just go old school and transfer over from the computer for now, but a really, really nice device. Well, everybody, it was awesome to talk with you all this week and hear a little bit about your tips for sharper photos. And thank you for joining us on the Improved Photography Podcast and for your download. Be sure to check out our other shows. Darren, what did you guys talk about on Portrait Session this week?
We actually did a rewind. Someone wrote into Improved Photography and they said, how did you all start your businesses as portrait photographers and go professional? So go ahead and join us on this week's episode of Portrait Session to find out how Erica Kay started, how Nick started, and how we and myself got to where we are in the photography world.
Very cool. And Brian, what happened on Thoughts on Photography this week?
I recently had Erica on my show, actually, just with the wedding season kicking off here. She and I talked about wedding workflow.
That was a great episode, by the way. I heard a lot of really good feedback on that one. And also Photo Taco, I'm pretty sure not many of you are missing that show because it's been really, really popular and just gaining consistently. So be sure to subscribe to those new episodes. Just take 1 second, pull out your podcatcher and subscribe to those new shows, and you will have more photography tips than you can shake a stick at. And we will see you next week.